All right. Judge Hooten, are you ready?
I am ready.
Great. Good morning, everyone. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Flory, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our virtual oral calendar today is the case of Abalazi versus Baker, and the file number is A200281. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and there will be a time clock that you can observe while you're making your oral argument on the screen. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument.
In this day and age, it's hard to believe that medical decisions are made, elective medical procedures are made for gastrointestinal surgeries the day of surgery. And yet that is essentially what Judge Ide decided in his order, and thus leading to the dismissal of the claims and dismissal of the case with prejudice, which is being appealed. In this particular
Mr. Anderson, case, can I clarify a procedural point? Is your client not raising as part of the appeal the count two, the battery dismissal?
Oh, yes.
Yes. So is it on the same basis that the court erred in finding an unambiguous contract based on the consent and that there's no need for parole evidence? So your point being is that would apply to both counts one and two equally?
Yes. Yes, that's my understanding. The count one and count two, when count one was dismissed, that was the grounds for the dismissal of count two. According to the order of the judge, ID, I'll refer to that first, I think. He is dismissing the count one based on the parole evidence rule, and because count one is dismissed, then there's no evidence to have the battery and unlawful touching for count two. Judge Ide made a number of observations in his memorandum, and his standards of law were right on point with many things. However, his second paragraph under summary judgment indicates that summary judgment is not a substitute for trial and may be granted only if, based on the entire record, no issue of material facts exists. That, citing Bixler, the question of whether he looked at the entire record is material here, and the issues of material fact do exist if you look at the entire record. Appellant is claiming that this case should not have been decided upon a finding of fact by Judge Ide that there was only one component of the development of this so-called informed consent. The authorization to proceed with this surgery, in fact, is based upon a multitude of contradictory medical records. I want to first visit the brief medical record exhibits. Exhibit two attached to my declaration was dated September 20th of 2016, where Dr. Baker requests the vertical sleeve procedure for Medica approval. Page three is on September 22, 2016, which is Medica's approval of the vertical sleeve procedure only 2 days later. Then on November 8th, according to page 12, which is cited in the briefs, the patient refused the vertical sleeve procedure and wants the adjustable lap band procedure.
Mr. Anderson, can I interrupt you just a moment to clarify a position? If I understand correctly, your client does not deny that the only document that she and the doctor both signed is the consent. And your client also agrees, as I understand, that the consent is unambiguous.
The consent is not ambiguous, it's fraudulent. It's a productive, it's a disputed, honest agreement and a meeting of the minds of the parties.
Can I just clarify, though? My understanding is the two counts that your clients alleged are the breach of contract and battery. There's no fraudulent misrepresentation allegation, nor did I see in the record a specific fraudulent facts to support a fraudulent misrepresentation in the response to the summary judgment. But if I'm incorrect, if you would point me to that.
That is a good question. And if you understand it, under the patient's Bill of Rights, the patient requested all the medical records soon after the surgery. It was recognized that the wrong surgery she had rejected had been accomplished. And she immediately sought the records. The consent was not among them. In fact, the consent was not disclosed to the end of discovery after the opportunities to amend the complaint. The consent was after two plaintiffs' Rule 37 motions compelling disclosure of the entire record, because the record is a mess. Now, the plaintiffs didn't even know that Dr. Baker was an employee of Allina when all this went down. The record does reflect on page 12 on November 8th that she refused the vertical sleeve procedure, and according to Allina records, she was transferred to talk to Dr. Baker about it. Page 13 is on just a few days later, on the 14th of November, 2016, the application was made by Dr. Baker for the lap band procedure, and it was approved promptly. Dr. Baker himself even recommended the lap band procedure. That's page 5 and page 7 of those documents, that compilation of medical records. Then on page 4, on November 14th, 2016, the lap band was fully approved. And on November 8th, 2016, there's a record that the patient decided on the lap band procedure. That's in an Allina record. But on page 13, on November 19, 2016, the contradictions really become apparent, because Allina notes that the patient only approved for the lap band procedure. However, administratively, two administrators, one for Medica, the insurer, and one for Allina, the employer, decided to change it to the vertical sleeve procedure without any contact with the patient. And
can I ask you this? I mean, is the only form that was signed here was the consent form, right? Am I correct? That's the only form that she signed?
I think you're asking if the consent on the date of surgery is the only form that Dr. Baker signed. It is not. He signed his recommendation. What?
And that she signed as well.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing.
I believe she's inquiring about whether the only document signed, and Judge Hooten, you can correct me, is the consent form that both parties, both your client as well as the doctor.
The doctor signed his recommendation for the lap band procedure and seeking the approval for the lap band procedure. Those are documents 5, 7, and 4 that's referred to. A contract does not have to be necessarily in writing. And in this day and age, when you're planning a surgery for a year, you're not changing the procedure immediately before the surgery when you're in your hospital gown and your preoperative bed. And yet that's exactly when the patient was ambushed with the alleged consent, which she doesn't remember. Nobody remembers it.
Mr. Anderson, you use the phrase ambush, and I'm a little unsure in the record how you arrive at that, but my understanding from the record, Mr. Anderson, is that she was read the document perhaps multiple times, had no questions. She repeated the surgery when the second nurse asked her what surgery was to be performed, and there was no inconsistencies with any of that. Here's my question, Mr. Anderson. If you concede that the consent form is unambiguous, then what you're objecting to, if I understand correctly, is the judge's phrase, the only contract. Can you point me to some specific language? And apparently you're conceding your client, there's no other written contract. What specifically in the record did you point to Judge Ide, and that you would point to us that would be an error in which there was an agreement by both the doctor and her do some other surgery or somehow that would be separate from the consent form, which is the last document that we have and the only agreement that we can see, at least in paper?
Yes. First of all, to answer your question, I need to visit what the consent was agreed to. And the consent form was disputed as to her signature, as to the presentation, as to what the consent form says. Somebody drafted that multi-page consent form, hitting all the bases of waivers. But that was done before the patient was approached preoperatively, immediately before she was approached. And it was to bootstrap the earlier behaviors of the administrators that had decided behind the patient's back to change it back again on, December 5th of 2016. There is no medical record that we've received for that date, but it's very close to the November 8th date where we do have a record and notes from the nurses indicating that the lap band procedure was the only one that was authorized.
Mr. Anderson, you make reference to change behind her back. Now, again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in looking at the record, it looks like that certainly she may have gone back and forth with doctors, but initially the sleeve was indeed what she wanted to be done. She then went back for a follow-up with the doctor, as I understand, to consider an alternative, which is what ultimately was not done. And the doctor, if the record I read correctly, says, let me know if you do want to change. And there was no other evidence subsequent to that other than the consent to do the sleeve. So I'm still confused as to what part of the record that you would point us to. But moreover, my question, Mr. Anderson, if your client did not allege misrepresentation but breach of contract, what specifically contract in the record would there be besides the consent form?
Well, I started trying to get to that, but I understand what you're saying. Now, first of all, the patient never requested the vertical sleeve procedure. That was Dr. Baker that went into that in September. And when she found out about it, she rejected it. And that didn't change until she was right before surgery when they allegedly brought this so-called informed consent. Allegedly, she refused an interpreter, which the witnesses, the patient, and an independent witness say that didn't happen. She didn't read all that. I wouldn't ask to interpret the Amir Hassan.
But the informed consent, what the question is, Mr. Anderson, that I think we've tried to get answered is, you have pled a breach of contract for failure to perform the lap band. What can you point us to in the record that that element of your claim, the formation of a contract, occurred?
If I'm understanding it right, I was referring to the evidence that was presented to Judge Idy and on the record. Page 5 and page 7 are the doctor's recommendation that it be a lap band and approved as a lap band.
But that's not a contract. What is the contract? Where is the meeting of the minds? What evidence is there that there was a meeting of a mind for the formation of a contract to perform the lap band as you have pled?
Well, the patient's pleading that she wanted the lap band procedure. She wasn't asked to sign any document. She was just, the medical records are reflecting that the lap band procedure had been decided upon back in November 14th, and it was changed unilaterally by administrators back to the vertical sleeve on December 5th. Between December 5th and the date of surgery on the 22nd of December, there was no communication about the vertical sleeve procedure. And somebody prepared this so-called informed consent to touch on interpretations and other reading all this stuff. Now, it's important to note that in Bonnie Peterson's declaration, she says, I don't remember the event at all. The plaintiff says it didn't happen. The non-party witness Amira Hassan said, I was there, it didn't happen. So in spite of the fact that there is information on this alleged informed consent and some scribbling on it, which is denied to be Abdelaziz's signature, that doesn't represent the contract. It represents evidence of fraud in trying to come up with an excuse why they did what they decided to do that the patient had previously rejected. Now, if you take the whole medical record in the context and the actions in the whole record, there's something going on here that shouldn't be going on. And the contract.
Hold on a second, Judge Hooten, we can't hear you. What is that?
I just wanted to say that your time has expired by more than 2 minutes.
Thank you.
So you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I understand.
Thank you. The respondent may proceed.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Putnam, and I'm here today arguing on behalf of respondent Dr. Jeffrey Baker. And I'm here today asking this court to affirm the judgment of the lower court, the dismissal of the case based on the court's finding that there was no genuine fact precluding summary judgment in favor of Dr. Baker on the only two claims that have been asserted in this case, that being correct. And the medical assault and battery, but I think correctly analyzed by the lower court as a medical battery. As you know, this case arises out of bariatric surgery Dr. Baker performed back on December 22nd, 2016. Ms. Abdelaziz that day signed a consent form for a left sleeve gastrectomy. That is the exact procedure that was performed by Dr. Baker. And on that day, in addition to signing the consent, he verbally confirmed that procedure at least twice. And it's actually more than twice, but I'm gonna stay away from disputed issues of fact. There are two occasions which are not disputed. That is when Dr. Baker himself came into the room and confirmed it with Ms. Abdelaziz. She confirmed that she wanted to leave. And then a sworn affidavit provided to Monica Kroll, who was the circulating nurse for the procedure. One of her responsibilities is to also confirm the procedure the patient's having done, and she did just that, and documented in the medical record. You can't have surgery in this stage without several people asking you on the day of surgery who you are, what your date of birth is, what procedure you're having. That's exactly the process that was followed here. And the appellants want to characterize it as somehow deceitful or an ambush that all this happened on the day of surgery, but that is standard of care as testified by Dr. Baker, and that is exactly the process that followed. It was all done on the morning of surgery, and that's the latest, greatest manifestation of her consent on that day.
Ms. Putney?
I want to talk.
Ms. Putney, yes. Was there evidence in the record? I'm curious in terms of the procedure. Indeed, is this typical for any surgeries for your client that the only document that's actually signed by both parties is the one on the day of surgery, so that all prior meetings, pre-op appointments, and so forth, I assume the surgery is discussed, but the point being is the only time there's ever a written document to confirm the particular surgery is the day of surgery.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to use absolutes like it never happens that way than this, but certainly it's standard of care. That is what is typically done. You have one consent form that's signed on the day of surgery. That's what Dr. Baker testified to. That exact process was followed here. Now, there was some testimony by Dr. Baker that Mr. Anderson has referenced in briefing, and I think here this morning, about authorizations happening earlier. I believe what he's referring to are the insurance authorizations. And Ms. Abdelaziz was in fact authorized for both the sleeve and the band because she at different times did express interest in both of those surgeries. Dr. Baker is not involved in that insurance authorization process. He didn't sign anything. The form letters that go come from care coordination within Allina. Allina is not a defendant in this case. Dr. Baker is the sole defendant. He is not responsible nor legally liable for anything in care coordination. If hypothetically there was some sort of mix up or misunderstanding there, and I'm not saying there was, but if there was, he was not involved in that. He's not responsible for that. And he can't be held accountable for a battery when the patient that he's operating on, to his face and in a written document, confirms that he is performing the correct procedure. He testified about those Medica insurance authorizations, testified he's not involved in them, did not see those documents at the time. His name does appear that he recommends the band, and he clarified that he did not sign that. Care coordination signed that, and care coordination's initials are right there on the document indicating that Dr. Baker was not the person who signed that. The court has correctly asked for evidence of some sort of other agreement in the record that would suffice for a contract for the lap band. I mean, that is the breach of contract case here, is that the plaintiff alleges in the complaint there was a contract between Ms. Abdelaziz and Dr. Baker for the lap band, but there is no such evidence of any such contract in the record we have here. The only only written document certainly we have is the consent, but even with respect to an oral agreement, I mean, the court has asked Mr. Anderson, Judge Idy asked Mr. Anderson, and it doesn't appear in the briefing, any sort of specific facts that the plaintiff has come forward in this case to demonstrate some sort of other agreement that existed for the lap band. It just doesn't exist in this record. You know, again, the conversations and insurance authorizations were not between Dr. Baker and Ms. Abdelaziz. She was approved for both, and he performed the one that she indicated that day that she wanted.
Ms. Putney, in terms of the affidavits of the, I believe it was two different nurses. One was she called herself a circulating nurse, and then there was another, I can't remember the title. But both of them did indicate in their affidavit, I believe, that they didn't have specific knowledge, but then they, in their affidavit, identified their usual procedure, and then they perhaps compared that to their notes from that day. Do you observe any weakness in that? That's one thing appellant has pointed out in terms of summary judgment, the fact that they do not recall the specific, consciously recall her or that incident, yet they did testify in their affidavits as to their usual procedure, including reading of the consent form and her agreement to it.
No, I mean, that's perfectly permissible testimony, and it's not surprising that they wouldn't remember specifically a patient from 2016 when they're following their usual course of procedure pre-operatively, which is confirming the procedure that is done. And Monica Prohl simply isn't disputed. I mean, Ms. Abdelaziz has not said one word through her briefing about any conversations with the circulating nurse, simply undisputed. She claims not to recall Dr. Baker coming into the room before the surgery, so she cannot dispute his recollection of their conversation. Ms. Abdelaziz's daughter, who was in the room, does confirm that Dr. Baker came in to the room. And Ms. Peterson, I mean, she contemporaneously documented everything that happened. So in addition to her affidavit, we have the admissible medical record here that she wrote that day, indicating the process that she followed. And I'm not relying on Bonnie Peterson exclusively, because I know that Ms. Abdelaziz claims that she doesn't remember Ms. Peterson. You know, she takes issue with a lot of what Ms. Peterson wrote in her note, that she didn't refuse an interpreter, that it wasn't read to her. But aside from that, I mean, we have contemporaneous declaration. But on top of that, we have separate communication with Dr. Baker and with Monica Prohl about this. And again, it's not unusual that several people ask you what procedure you're having before you have surgery in this day and age. And that's, again, the exact process that was followed here. I want to comment a little bit about the battery claim. You know, that was not briefed by the appellant in the brief, and it has been waived by failing to brief it. Aside from that, I will address it. And there are undisputed facts, and they're the facts that we just talked about. Appellant signed a consent form here, and then she verbally confirmed it at least two times that are not disputed in the record. The critical issue in a battery claim is whether the doctor explained the procedure and the patient consented. Consent is defined in our CIVJIG 60.15, which is the battery jury instruction. Consent is defined as an apparent willingness that the touching, in this case, the vertical sleeve surgery, take place. Certainly, Ms. Abdelaziz manifested to Dr. Baker on the day of surgery an apparent willingness that this surgery take place. She signed a consent form. Mr. Anderson, or appellant, excuse me, seems, again, to imply that this whole process is somehow suspect, or that she was ambushed, or it was done behind her back. I mean, again, Dr. Baker's the only defendant in this case. He was not even present at the time the consent form was signed. So he certainly didn't thrust it upon her. He didn't. She also testified that if she had questions, which she didn't, that she could have asked them and she felt they would have answered. She has testified that she understands the difference between band and sleeve, so that element of battery, a battery claim is not satisfied by the plaintiff, because Dr. Baker did in fact explain the nature of the surgery he was performing. He had explained both the sleeve and the band in prior visits. So we have certainly an apparent willingness that this surgery take place. And again, it's important to note that if Ms. Abdelaziz, you know, she claims to not understood, she certainly had the opportunity to ask questions, acknowledges she did, acknowledges she had no questions, acknowledges she understood the difference in the terms, and she knew what they meant for purposes of her surgery. In addition, she had her daughter with her. I mean, if there's a dispute about whether an interpreter showed up or didn't show up, it's immaterial. It makes no difference because she had no questions and because her daughter was there to interpret as necessary. So,
Am I correct that if I saw this correctly in the record, that the doctor also separately met with her prior to anesthesia, I assume, to confirm the surgery she wanted him to perform?
Absolutely. Yep.
Was the daughter still present with her at that point as well? Does the record indicate that?
I believe she was in the room.
So that would have been the last of, if I count correctly, three times where she repeated the surgery. In other words, after the reading of the consent, she signed it. I think the second nurse then confirmed it, and then the doctor did as well.
I think it's actually a little bit different order. Bonnie Peterson was the admitting nurse, so that all of Ms. Peterson's interactions came first. Then Dr. Baker comes into the room after the consent form is signed by Ms. Abdelaziz. He comes in, he confirmed it with her, and then he signs the consent. And then it's Monica Prohl is actually the circulating nurse, meaning she's a nurse in the operating room. So that is the last person. So she came after Dr. Baker. But it's done. I know Mr. Anderson asked questions about whether this is, she's under anesthesia. It's certainly done before any sedation or anesthesia is given to the patient. So, but just in terms of order, that's the order in which I understand the verbal consents took place.
I'm curious, and Mr. Anderson pointed out that it required two motions to compel to actually get a copy of the consent form. Is that your understanding as well? It surprised me a bit, since that would be a key document, I assume, among the initial disclosure that would be made.
It's actually not accurate. Thank you for raising that, because I had made a note to address that. It is true that Appellant's counsel brought two Rule 37 motions for sanctions against me, both of which were very flatly rejected by the district court. This consent form was produced with the patient's medical record. I have no idea why Mr. Anderson was not aware of it. And in fact, when we went to the first hearing and I asked him why he was pursuing this claim, if there was a consent form, he said he wasn't aware of the consent form. And I said, well, it's in the records. And he claimed not to have seen it, but it was certainly produced. And the Rule 37 motions brought against me for sanctions were, again, flatly rejected by the district court. And I encourage you to take a look at the orders in the district court record on that point. But that was not an accurate representation of what occurred in this case. You're absolutely right that the consent form is a key document and a document that was included in the medical record and produced with the medical record. I see my time is winding down. I'm happy to address any other questions that the panel may have. Thank you for your time. I would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court in the summary judgment dismissal of the claims against Dr. Baker. Thank you.
All right, you may proceed.
Your microphone's on mute. You're muted. Yeah, you need to unmute, Mr. Anderson.
I assume that this court recognizes that it is a material fact whether or not a consent was made and what procedure was authorized. That is a contractual issue and a very material issue in this dispute. And it is, Judge Ivey did not decide that based on the entire record, which is required under Bixler, but he made essentially a decision of fact that the alleged informed consent was the only contract. That's wrong. The parties have a right to make contract orally, in writing, and a combination of the two. By their actions. If you study the actions in this case, and particularly page 7, the exhibit, under Dr. Jeffrey D. Baker, MD's signature in both printed and arguably in writing, he's recommending the adjustable lap band procedure because that's what the patient had authorized. And it, again, the appellant feels ambushed. In this day and age, there's no reason for consents to be steered the way they were steered in this course, just by protocols of Allina and the medical giants. More and more, it just seems like the HIPAA is created not to protect the patients, but it's created to make it impossible to hold the caregivers accountable. And I know that what Kelly Putney had said was correct, that I was unaware of the consent form after the Rule 37 motion, the first one, and it wasn't supplied for a long time thereafter until the end of discovery, when we first became aware that there was even an allegation of such a document. It is a disputed issue, and the judge made resolve that issue as a matter of fact to initiate the parole evidence implementation, which he favored, and that did take care of the case. If we believe that the credibility of the parties should have been weighed at trial, subject to cross-examination, a presentation of the full medical record, and then we would have a fair outcome. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.